And I love that word smashed. Because smashed means to me that, like, if I break a plate in half, I can get out some crazy glue and I can glue that plate back together. Thinking that maybe one more time I'm going to be able to eat like a normal person. Or look at how other people eat and go, I can eat like that. Or look at people I sponsor and go, well, maybe I can eat sugar or maybe I can eat pasta. But my abstinence is what it is. It is what it is. I mean, I got to eat this way. It's not because I'm altruistic. It's not because I'm feeling really want to feel wonderful and float above. It's because I know what happens when I eat those foods. So that concept that I can someday be a normal eater is gone. I will always be a compulsive overeater, which is step one. And when I'm taking step one, it means there ain't no way I'm going to eat sugar again. Because if I eat sugar, love, you know my story that I was, before I came in, a doctor told me if I didn't stop eating sugar, I'd be blind within a year. And I put on 30 pounds in 6 weeks. And as I was bending my way through Europe, putting on that 30 pounds, I said, I can, I'll stop when it goes gray. So that concept of if I eat sugar, I will go back to being blind. I will kill myself because I will want to kill myself. Not because I think I want to, but because I have to. Because if I'm not killing myself with sugar, which there will not be enough sugar, I will have to kill myself with a gun. Because there will no way I can live with what happens to my brain when I eat. I just can't live with this brain when I'm binging. When I'm in my disease, this brain is really, really a god-awful place. Because all it wants to do is tell me how I'm a worthless piece of shit and I do not have a right to live. And that there is no way that I can feel comfortable in my own skin. And that I might as well just end it because it will never, ever get better. It will never, ever change. That this is the way it's going to be the rest of my life. Misery, discontent, and fear. Now, one of the reasons I believe I'm still abstinent after 33 years is that when I was about 4 or 5 years abstinent, I got sick, and I was going through a lot of, emotional struggle, financial struggle, and I was just basically hit bottom. Don't think that you hit bottom just binging. There's other bottoms that we will hit when we're abstaining. But the difference between hitting a bottom when you're abstaining and hitting a bottom when you're binging is when you have abstinence, you have hope. You have a guide rope out. When you hit bottom binging, you have no way out. The answer to the solution when you're binging and hitting rock bottom is to take another bite, which digs you deeper to the bottom. The answer when we have abstinence is it says work a step, work a program, and life will change. Is that so? When I was in this horrific turmoil, and I cried, I was crying, and I said, God, I do not get it. I do not understand why I have to go through this. But I make a commitment to you, God, that I will abstain to get to the other side so I know the reason why. And that is one of the reasons I believe I'm abstinent 33 years. It's because I made the commitment to abstain no matter what, no matter how horrible life gets. Because life does get horrible. And if you're new, and as those people know me, that's 10 years or less of abstinence. It does get better after some time. And if you're in that 7-year time frame, bless your heart. I'm going to tell you right now, it is rank and it stinks right now if you're 7 to 8 years old. It sucks big time because the resurgence of the human ego comes back after 5 because we start thinking that we know it all, that we've got our stuff together. Because people tell me that I've got it together at 5, 6, 7 years. But the human ego resurges itself and comes back and bites you in the ass. So if you're 7, 8 years absence, baby, hang in there. It's going to get better. Don't leave. But age 7 years, when I was 7, 8 years abstinence, I was banging on the dashboard of a dear friend in program, saying, damn it, I did everything they asked me to do. I wrote those inventories, I listened to those people, I went to meetings, I did everything. And it sucks. And those old timers lie to me because misery loves company and they just want me up there with them. I'm not lying. It gets better. Now, don't expect that you can put in, I mean, I don't, I hear this all the time where I think people go like, I'm going to put in 3 meditations, crank that, you know, slot machine handle and out comes a new car. Or I'm going to say, you know, I'm going to go work with a newcomer and go do something, and crank that handle and I'm get abstinent. I don't believe there is a God of that you do 3 acts of goodwill and good deeds and you get something in return. What this program has given me is it has not given me any external gift except for weight loss. The only thing this program has given me is internal. In the last few years, I've really gotten in touch with inside job. When I was 7, 8, maybe 13 years abstinent, I was driving to a meeting and I was going to share at the meeting. You know how we think about what we're going to share about? I was going to share at the meeting how wonderful life was. Because I got this new car, I got this great job, I got this new apartment, and I'm going to come tell you people how wonderful life is and how good the program works. And the thought occurred to me, so if I lose the job, will I have a horrible life? If I lose my car, does that mean I'm going to crater and life is not worth living? And the thought came, no. I could be homeless on the street, but still enjoy life because it's internal. And it made me realize that if I go external to find something that's going to make me happy, then there will always be something that disappears. My sister, who was in program, used to call it money, marbles, and chalk. Money, marbles, and chalk. That it really doesn't, that you can hold on to it for 1 second, but it's going to disappear. This program has made me go inside and change. And that is the reason why I'm absent for so long. I've been willing to grow and change. Humility step 7 says, I'm not the answer. That I don't have all the answers. That I don't know everything. So if you listen to some of my sponsees, I'll probably tell you that I do. If you listen to a lot of people in this program, you might think I do. I had the benefit of going to Houston, Texas, and when I was 3 to 5 years abstinent. And I had long-term abstinence then. I was one of the long-termers there. And they treated me as a guru, where I'd walk into a meeting and the last, like 10 minutes before the meeting was over with, dying and needing a meeting so bad, desperate for a meeting. And I would sit down going, I'm in a meeting, and the leader would say, Terrell, would you sum up the topic for us? And my human ego said, well, of course I will. Being a guru gets you nowhere in this program. The reason why I work this program is to be peace inside. You know, if you want to go be a circuit speaker, go be a circuit speaker. It's not glamorous. I assure you. The places I've been in Anchorage, Alaska in January with a bad hip and twisted my ankle. Now that tells you, like, oh yeah, I'm doing this very spiritual act. Go up into Anchorage, Alaska in January to lead a retreat. I shouldn't be getting hurt. But no. There is no payoff by working a good program except I find peace. Internal peace. The thing about commitment, I love what you talked about commitment. Because a commitment means, I always tell everyone, do not write a check with your mouth that your ass won't cash. Because what I say, I don't want to hear a commitment, but I'm going to commit to do this, I'm going to commit to do that. Because you keep a commitment even if your ass falls off. You keep that commitment. Because if I don't keep a commitment, I lose my integrity. And this program teaches me integrity. It makes me become whole. That's what this program does for me by working the steps. I was I was working with this sponsor when I was about 7 years absent, maybe six. And I was complaining about some man, you know, because I always talk about some man. You know, it was always some man not doing it right. Didn't call me or whatever. Wasn't loving me the way I should be loved. And, you know, we were talking about that newcomer talk. Oh, God. You know. And she told me to write as inventory in the seven deadly sins. And I thought, seven deadly sins? Are you crazy, woman? I'm talking about this relationship, and you want me to write on the seven deadly sins? That was what I was thinking. I didn't say it to her because, you know, she was my sponsor. So I was driving down to Long Beach to see this guy, and I got there a little early, and I'm thinking, I don't want to write this inventory. I'll screw that inventory. But the thought occurred to me, if I break this commitment to my sponsor about I'm going to write this inventory, which commitment do I stop at? Which commitment? Right, the commitment that I'm going to, you know, make my bed in the morning. The commitment that I'm going to brush my teeth. The commitment that, I'm going to meet you for dinner. Or the commitment that I'm going to keep my abstinence no matter what. So I saw a direct relation between the commitment to write that inventory and the commitment to break my abstinence. And my abstinence is what saves my life. It's what allows me to breathe. When I'm binging, all I can think about is how you're better than me, and I don't have a right to live. The choice for me between abstaining and not abstaining, because I'm a compulsive overeater, is death or life. But it goes back to taking that first step that says I'm powerless over food. Our literature is very clear. It says I cannot work the remaining steps if I don't take the first step. It also is very clear in the AA 12 and 12, it says John Barleycorn is our best advocate. In other words, food is our best advocate. So if you think you can go out and eat some more, if you think you can control food, try it, baby. Just go for it. We're not going to stop you. But all I can tell you, I was told that I would be blind within a year if I didn't stop eating sugar and put on 30 pounds. So eyesight, a chocolate is worth more than my eyesight. For crying out loud, everyone knows that. One bite of chocolate is worth more than an eyesight. The only way I know that I stayed absent for so long is I believe. I believe what you tell me. You gave me hope. You said that without abstinence, I'm hopeless. I hope it gets better. I don't know of any other reason of why I stayed abstinent. I don't work that great of a program. In my world, when the OA 12 and 12 came out, I read it, and I went to my sponsor and said, Natalie, I'm working a really bad program. Oh my God, this is an amazing book. I'm working a really bad program. And she looked at me and says, Cheryl, you're crazy. You've got like 18, 19, some 20-something years. What do you mean you're working a bad program? Because I never live up. This program has taught me self-acceptance. I love that because one of my favorite sayings is, oh, well. Oh, well. You know, I can bring out that whipping stick so quickly to beat myself up. Because it talks about in our OA 12 and 12, in some imagined ladder of worth. And if I'm on that, if I lack that humility and I'm on some imagined ladder of worth, for 1 minute, I'm going to be above you. And 5 minutes, I'm going to be below you. 3 minutes, I'm going to be above you. 20 minutes, I'm going to be below you. Got it? I'm never going to be staying up above. Because that's what my head wants to tell me. So for me, the most spiritual thing I can say is, oh well. Oh well. You know, my prayer for many, many years was, God, let me be the best human being possible. What that meant to me is that I'm a human being. And I was also turned my higher power to help me go to achieve higher. But to admit the fact that I'm a human. And I think those are the reasons why I'm still abstinent. Now, if you've been around for a while and you want to go like, well, I go to the kitchen sink, we have questions and answers. And all the time you get for people who have been around for have a long-term absence, they'll say, so how do you keep your program fresh? To me, I'm thinking, do you not eat? Like, seriously, I mean, do you not eat? I mean, can you not have a meal and the meal makes you go like, whoa, okay, well, now that, you know. Because I'm already perfectly clear. Oh, and the other thing that I believe is that service. You want to keep your program fresh? Do service at the intergroup level. It was like 20-something years I became chair of the LA intergroup. It definitely changed my program. Made it look at me differently. Then I started doing that. I did something for the Region 2 treasurer last year. Region 2 conference convention treasurer. Made me look at my program. You think it's going to get stale? Now, one thing I also did, if you're like me, you're probably going to complain. I mean, I was complaining for umpteen years about how all I did was go to meetings. I had no social life. I just went out to meeting every single friggin' day. It seemed like I go to meetings. I would go to meetings 3 to 4 or 5 times a week. Can't I just get a break and go out and have a lovely life? Well, like I said, if you're new, keep working on that foundation. And we all know that new is 10 years or less. You keep working on that foundation, maybe, by going to meetings constantly and working with people constantly. And maybe when you get 30-something years, maybe you can not go to so many meetings. So don't worry about how many meetings you go to. All I know is when I was new, I went to 5, 6, 7 meetings a week. I went to fellowship. And I became an active member of Overeaters Anonymous, even though I didn't want to be one. Because I don't want to be a member of Overeaters Anonymous. I can't imagine me ever saying, I am glad I'm a member of Overeaters Anonymous. I'd much rather find spirituality other ways. I'd much rather wish I didn't need a program. But the bottom line is I need a program. Because of that, you folks have given me an answer. An answer to my problem that says, I'm worthless. And because of working a 12-step program, I have self-acceptance. And really okay with who I am. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you all very much. Now what we're going to do is present the questions that were put into the Ask It basket. First one is, what do you do to sustain long-term absence on a day-to-day basis? In other words, how do you overcome not being willing to go to any lengths in the program? What do you do to sustain long-term absence on a day-to-day basis? In other words, how do you overcome not being willing to go to any lengths in the program? You need to come up here. Yeah.
I think in a way we pretty much covered that for us, but I'll just add that one of the things I do on a daily basis is I get on my hands and knees. I'm Jewish, and I was taught that's not something you normally do. I do it now. And I get on my hands and knees, and I say, hi, God, here I am, God, use me. That's my prayer. And that helps me. Thank you.
How many times have each of you been through the steps in your years in program?
I have, how many times have I been through the steps? It's because there are many ways that you can do the steps. I mean, I've done, I think, inventories 3 different ways. First time, you know, like through the book, the way the big book, and I did another inventory, and then you get into, if you're a Pacific Group guy, you know, is it a 4-step or is it another 10-step? You know, and you can get so wound up in that. It doesn't matter. You just keep doing them. Something always comes up.
I think that's a theoretical question you need not concern yourself with. Because literally, are you working a 12-step program today? And it becomes like, well, how am I going to work it? Am I doing the right, do I need to do it 5 times this year? How many times do I need to write a 4-step? It's a theoretical question. We don't concern ourselves with theory. You worked the 1st step when you woke up this morning. If you need to make amends, make amends. If you've got a major inventory to write, write your inventory. If you haven't written a 4-step, write one and get it done within a week. Those are pragmatic answers to dealing with food. Not how many times do I write, or how many times do I work the steps, how many times have I worked the steps this year, or this in 33 years. Because if I literally said, well, I'm working step 7, so I can't write 10 step today, that would, to me, would be, yeah, I think, yeah, anyway. Opinionated old-timer, by the way.
How important is your conscious contact with your higher power today, and what do you do to maintain that contact, and why do we have to work so hard to get that contact? Are you at peace? I'll leave the question here as you go.
Sometimes it's good and sometimes it isn't good. Basically, I feel like I'm in contact with my higher power. I feel like the decisions I've made in the larger issues of my life are in harmony with what I'm supposed to be doing. And I have that sense of rightness about it. And that's wonderful, but that's not day by day. And day by day, I notice that if I take time in the morning to reflect on my day, and to think through what I'm doing that day and to align myself with it, I do better. And I used to do that more when I work. And now when I'm not working and I'm retired, I don't always do that. And sometimes my day goes amiss because I haven't taken the time to think about my higher power and to think about what I'm supposed to be doing that day. And if that goes on for a few days or a week, I could get myself into trouble in my thinking. And then I think, oh, I better do some writing. And so it's probably better to do it every day, but if you don't do it every day, life will tell you to get back to it or you get a mess.
Do all of us have to hit bottom before getting help? Or are we all stupid?
Yes and yes.
Let me just give you a quick example of what happened to me. I told you about 10 years ago, I was finally able to lose the final 10 pounds. So what happened was, I said I've been wrestling with this issue of, there's not always one issue that people eat over, right? I mean, like, I just, like, ate, right? And I said to my therapist I'd been with for many years, right? And she looked at me and she said, no, usually there's one issue. I just thought, fuck you, is what I wanted to say, but I didn't. And then not long after that, I had this explosive issue with my sister. Explosive. I only have one sibling. And I honestly never wanted to see her again. And it was fear. It frightened me so much to think about that. And I realized a lot of things about our relationships. And it was at that moment that everything fell away, and I saw that as the streaming golden light, and this was my issue. This was what I modeled my whole life after. This is what I was running from and defending against everything. And she and I were lucky because we had the resources, and we were really like two countries at war. But we finally were willing, because there was a basis of love, that we met with both of our therapists together about 4 times a year, so that I had my translator, she had her translator, I had my defender, she had her defender. It was expensive. And it was so worth it because our relationship is healthier and our communication is better. But I did have to hit bottom. I had to hit bottom with that, with her, to sort of see.
How do you change your food plan and maintain your spiritual practices when the challenges are overwhelming? How do you change your food plan and maintain your spiritual practices when the challenges are overwhelming?
overwhelming. Where's God in that question? One of our favorite sayings is God never gives me more than I can handle. And God has a higher opinion of me than I do of myself. How do you change your food plan and maintain your spiritual practices? If you're changing your food plan, talk to your sponsor. You don't change it on your own. I'll give you a classic example. I told you I don't eat wheat products. I went to my sponsor when I was about 9 years old, something like that, I know. And he told her I want to eat pasta. And she said, okay, which is not what she was supposed to say. But I made a commitment, I would bookend it to her. And I tried for a week to eat pasta, but it never felt right for me to eat pasta. And finally I went to God and said, God, if I'm to eat pasta, make it okay. If I'm not to eat pasta, make it okay. And I never ate pasta. And it's okay. So how do you change your food plan? It's how do we change my food plan? Because that's how we do this. If it was to you to determine what is a perfect food plan, which, by the way, I also find an excuse for a diet for a lot of people on program, or another word for diet, is food plan. But the answer is not in the food plan. There is not a perfect food plan. There's a food plan that works for you today. And make that commitment to your food plan and talk to someone about it and talk to God. But not how do you change your food plan. How do we change our food plan?
If I were to eat the way I used to eat when I came to program, my life would be overwhelming in 3 or 4 days. That it's my experience that by having a food plan that works for me, food then is not my problem and not my issue, and I live and deal with the issues out there in my life. And if I were not to have a food plan that worked for me, my life would be overwhelming. And so it's very important to find a good food plan that's going to work for you so you can deal with your life on its own terms. Thank you.
Yeah, there's kind of a similar question, but I guess they wanted to know from each person what their abstinence is and what their food plan is. And then they wanted to know if anybody currently weighs and measures and if they could talk about that and then how that's changed over the years. So maybe the other two who didn't share want to talk about that piece of it.
You run that by me. I have never weighed and measured. And I was discouraged from weighing and measuring. My wife goes to Hal, and there is no difference between Hal and us. Like Carol said it well, I think, in terms of it's a we thing. Here's the thing about the difference between food plan and abstinence. I mean, I have what I was told to do, and the only thing that we have to share is experience, strength, and hope. We are not doctors. We are not therapists. This is not Insight Anonymous, you know. So what I get to do if I have a problem is ask what my sponsor's experience is. Relating to that question, the difference, what I was told to do was do a food inventory, and what that meant, I was specifically told to get legal size paper, that is the yellow stuff because it's longer, divided into 3 columns. This is what I was told to do long ago. And in the first column, foods that I could eat that didn't matter to me. Like I never started a binge with beets because I don't like beets. So those kind of things. In the second column, foods that I could eat with that I had to put limits on and what the limit was. And it could be quantitative or qualitative. Then in the third column, guess what that is? Stuff, one bite is one too many, 52,000 is never going to be enough. And it's my list. And the good news was when I did that, I could eat off the first 2 columns. And it could change. And it was my relationship with the food that was counting. So that's how I started. And I still tell somebody what I'm going to eat every day. You know, and if I need to change it, I change it. Now, what Marty told me, which is in all things. Say what you mean what you say. See, we were talking about commitment and all that kind of stuff. Being overwhelmed, you know, all that. You know, I mean, there's always an excuse. You know, I'll probably want to overeat at my own funeral because the food will be good. But that's the whole point. And I also was told to look up the word abstain in the dictionary. And I did what I was told. And it's interesting, in Webster's, the big one, the example they use for abstinence is, and I remember this in italics, as in food. I remember seeing that and I think, oh, geez. Anyway, that's the thing. It's one day at a time. If you do this, one other thing. I can look anybody here in the eye and say, I have abstained from compulsive overeating. There have been times where I have overeaten. There are times when I've eaten compulsively. But I can look anybody in the eye, because here's the thing, is somebody has always known what I've eaten. Because I have to manifest this physically, you know, so that's how I see that.
So I started out by eating 3 meals a day, nothing in between, and at that time we had 2 sheets, gray sheet and orange sheet. And gray sheet had no bread, and orange sheet had bread. And it was three kinds of, it was like a protein and a this and a that. And I misread the sheet that I chose. I somehow thought it said, and you get it 1 glass of milk at night. It didn't say that anywhere. And for a year I thought it said that. And that sustained me, because then I would make these frothy things with ice in them and fake sugar. And, you know, God took care of me, because it doesn't say that anywhere. And then at some point I lost my way with my food. And so I was really having trouble in program. And I ended up looking in front of a person who said, would you like me to sponsor you? And I knew that she was Hitler. And I said no, but the word yes came out. I don't know how that happened. And this was the very precursor of How. And it was her sponsor, Lila, brought How to Los Angeles. And How, at that time, was a very, very directed program. It's what I needed. It would have been wrong for me earlier in the program, and it's wrong for a lot of people. It would have sent me screaming out to eat more if I had tried it at a different time for me. But at the time, it was really good, because I had to weigh and measure my food. I had to call my sponsor. There was nothing. I was newly starting a corporate job, and I had to weigh and measure my food before a banquet in the kitchen with the chef. And they turned out to be wonderful people, and it was a wonderful experience, but it was scary, scary. And so, as I said, I did that for 10 years. And then when I had to let go, it was, as Carol says, and as if you listen to all of us, it's all about working with another person and be accountable. It's accountability more than anything. So I'm going to fast forward to these last 10 years where I became, when I was engrossed in this difficulty with my sister, I thought I would start counting calories, something I've never done in my life, and I disagreed with vehemently. I thought it was nuts to count calories, that you would be more crazy about the food. But what I needed was something to keep my mind busy, my monkey mind busy, because I was so obsessed and frightened about my sister. I literally chose calories as a way to keep me distracted. And what I found about them for me in this point in my life, which would have been wrong for me earlier, is that it gives me a tremendous freedom. If I set this absolute calorie count, which is 1,700 calories or under for me, so if I mess up at breakfast, then I just have enough for the dinner. Or if I decide I want to have a big dinner that night, then I have this amazing, wonderful gift that I can give myself. Or I can see the warning signs during the day. Now, sometimes do I have 1,925 calories or 2,300 calories? I do, and I tell my sponsor. So it's a guide. It's not used as a whip. Thank you.
I came into OA 17 years ago and left after 2 years. How can I quit beating myself up about wasting 17 years? Came in 17 years ago, left after 2 years. How can I quit beating myself up about wasting 17 years?
You're here.
Okay.
it's what they kept telling me is who's running this. I heard it in AA, I've heard it here. If I'm beating myself up at 17, you know, for about 17 years, why am I beating myself up at all? I know, because I'm a compulsive overeater and that's what we do. But I think more of the problem of any of this stuff is that I keep trying to run the show, and guess what? I'm going to keep trying to do that because I'm a human being. That's there is no perfect. There is no perfect, you know. It's like what my sponsor tells me, Marty says, he says, you know, in the book, it says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. What he told me was the word path is not plural. And I came to understand that what it's talking about is a spiritual path. However, what Marty says, the pace you take it is up to you and your higher power and nobody else. And what that means for all of us may mean something different.
Have you ever relapsed, and what did you do to get back?
I came in the first time when I was 17. Lost 125 pounds and didn't work a program, so I had to go back out and eat. Came back in when I was in the fall of 1978, got abstinent, lost the weight I gained in Europe with 30 pounds. But you were not the answer. I found the answer to be in boys and dancing in Palm Springs. And I wound up binging, breaking my abstinence on January 6, 1979. And what happened was, for me, when I broke my abstinence, it was actually January 5th, 1979, when I broke my abstinence, this feeling came over me that says, I cannot do that one more time. I cannot binge one more time. I cannot suffer through that one more time. And it was not about food. It would never, this absence has never been about, oh, well, I'm just going to keep my weight up. Oh, I shouldn't say never, but it's, you know, this absence is about, I have a choice. I can eat and hate myself, or I can abstain and have hope. So that literally is, I guess that's what caused me this to, what changed? I can't do it one more time. I just, the thought of doing it one more time, wake up in the morning and hating myself because of what I ate the night before, one more time, it's just a steep, steep price. I don't know, that's what happened to me.
Okay, after all these years in program and abstinence, for what are you most grateful? How have you been changed? And what are the lessons that you've learned? In 30 seconds or less. No, I'm just kidding. If you want to answer anyway, for what are you most grateful? How have you been changed? And what are the lessons that you've learned?
Let me say it perfectly clear, not Michael. I'm grateful for
The thing I'm most grateful for is that when I came here, I was friendless, alone, looking desperately. I'd done so many things. I had a graduate degree. I had a couple of careers. I had marriage, divorce. I was searching for an answer to life, and I found it here. And there's no place else I need to look, and I keep it here. And the answer to life for me is that I look inside myself. It's not out there. It's in here, and I don't have to do it alone. I do it with all of you.
What am I most grateful for? That's what I'm going to answer. There is a quiet that's inside me that was never there before. And I truly believe, even in time of crisis, sometimes it takes me a while to remember this, and again, it's about asking for help so people can remind me that there is a reason for everything. And so, for example, when my sister's newborn baby began to have life-threatening seizures in the hospital at the day she was born, it was the first time in my life that instead of praying, God, save this child, I said, God, help us to deal with whatever comes. Help us to do, you know, whatever's best. And, for example, I dealt with many years of infertility, which were incredibly frightening. And this was, it took us 2 years to have my child, Jeff, and then 8 more years of dealing with it and deciding not to go on after that. I had a lot of pain around that. What I see now is I have a lot of quiet in my life. I was probably not destined to be the mother of 6. You know, he can go to someone else's house to get the siblings or to his cousin's house. And he is a wonderful, wonderful child, for which I am very grateful.
As your absence and recovery continued past that first year or two and life became bigger, how did you reconcile those new responsibilities that came with a bigger life and the actions demanded by your recovery and program? As your life became bigger, how did you reconcile those new responsibilities that came with a bigger life and the actions demanded by your recovery and program?
One day at a time. And that happened. I mean, that's been, I would suspect, with most of us, anybody who has any kind of recovery at all, that's what happens. Like, you know, Terrell, and I've heard it, you know, and I've had to say it, God would never give me anything I couldn't handle. And things have gotten bigger. I mean, I there have been great things that have gotten bigger and bad things that have gotten bigger. Like, for instance, like I said, you know, health was never an issue for me, but then it became an issue because sooner or later, anything that I haven't had to experience in life is going to come up. So I will share this for you. For instance, when I was 56 years old, I came in at age 34. I wanted to be the only one that never lost, that never gained an ounce, and that worked for about 16 years until things changed. After a meeting, I started feeling lightheaded, and my current wife, I've been through a divorce, and my current wife and I are real soulmates, and she noticed it, and so we went over to Sherman Oaks Hospital, and they took they hooked me up to an EKG, and their first initial diagnosis was that I had had some, what do they call it, angina of, of undetermined origin. In other words, they thought, initially, I had had a heart attack, but didn't know where or why. And I'm thinking, my life is over. Here, I've all this stuff, and I'm 56, and all this kind of stuff. They hooked me up, and I got to hear the experience of nitro gives you a headache like you wouldn't believe. And I'm thinking, well, at least I'll be able to eat. I was, you know, hooked up all night. Two of my sponsees came to see if I was okay, which is very, very cool. And what the thought was, if I could just get through this and tell the meeting, I'll be all right. That was the thought. And I couldn't eat because I was going to do a stress test at 11. So all that stuff, you know, you think, one of these things I understood is that when you're in pain or if things are difficult, it feels like it'll go on forever, you know. So I do a stress test at Sherman Oaks Hospital, and I, of course, been on the treadmill 5 days a week, and they told me later that I had done better on a treadmill than anybody they had ever seen. It was strictly anxiety. But I got through it. And I told the meeting I could get through it. And see, when you tell the meeting you can get through something, that's an inspiration to somebody else. It doesn't matter what it is. So if your life gets bigger, I've been through divorce, I've been through all kinds of things, I've been awarded things, I've been involved with an Oscar. You know, all kinds of good stuff and bad stuff happens. That's how your life gets bigger.
It,
And this also relates back to the other question, one of the most things I'm grateful for, and how do you handle life when it gets big, and it's called the breath, for me. I take a nice deep breath, and I tell this to people all the time. I say to clients, I say to my sponsees, breathe, just breathe. And then what happens, that maniacal craziness that April and I were talking about this beforehand. Oh no, Colleen and I were talking about this beforehand. This maniacal craziness that happens when you're new, you know, where you go like, I gotta get this done, I gotta get this done, I gotta get this done, and you're like, and then this is gonna, and you just wanna go, breathe. Take a nice deep breath, inhale, and exhale. Let the shoulders drop, and you will be able to do more in life than you ever thought possible. And I also do not stray from meetings. Meetings will maintain you through those periods of busy life. Even though you don't think you have time, make the time. Because without it, you will be insanely crazy, insanely busy, running on a treadmill. And our literature is very clear about how it talks about those newcomers when they come in. And often, I forget the exact phrasing, but it's like we find they have more energy. Because when you're running the show so desperately to try and range the show, it's very tiring and very taxing. And when you learn to breathe, you have more energy. So I think that's what I mean.
Okay. Thank you all very much for all the time that we have for the questions. There was someone who asked about experienced caregiving for a full-time dying parent, and April said that she'd be willing to talk to whoever that is they asked to speak. Okay. So if any others of you have experienced that, someone in the audience is looking specifically for that to talk to you personally. So, no one here is a spokesperson for OI. Everyone here spoke only for themselves. Thank you all for joining us, and please join me in thanking our panel members for sharing their experience, change, and hope. Let us all stand, join hands, and say the Serenity Prayer.
Keep coming back. It works if you work it and you're with it.